This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Avatar director James Cameron was just in the Amazon, meeting with tribes people who will be displaced by a new dam slated for the deep jungle. It's the Belo Monte Dam on the Xingu River, an upstream tributary. Flooding at least 400,000 square kilometers of forests and farms, if built, Belo Monte will be the world's third largest dam. Though the Brazilian courts recently ruled against it, the government has forged ahead, already awarding the construction contract. No one doubts the Brazilian people need more power, and they don't need the emissions and cost of coal or oil imports. The giant metropolis of Sao Paulo has gone dark or browned out many times. If South America cannot power its cities, the exodus to cut down the Amazon may be worse. Brazil also hopes to expand their electricity-hungry aluminum industry. And yet, everything about this mega-dam project doesn't make sense. As we learn from Amazon Watch, quote, the National Amazon Research Institute calculated that during its first 10 years of operation, Belo Monte would emit 112 million megagrams of CO2 equivalent, equal to the CO2 emissions of 2,156,000 passenger vehicles per year, end quote. When all is said and done, the Belo Monte Dam will add to the climate change that already threatens to dry out the Amazon, not to mention the lost species and the impact on the weather of not just Africa, but the whole planet. And during the long months of the dry season, this dam will hardly produce much, dropping to 10% of its rated capacity for 3 to 5 months, unless the Brazilian government builds another 5 damaging dams upstream to feed the complex. If the drought of 2005 returns, the project will fail, just as the electricity system of Venezuela is failing now due to lack of rain and runoff for hydropower. We're going to hear about that, with notes on our recent climate conference in Cochabamba, Bolivia, against the big picture of the drying Amazon. Our guest is Nicholas Kozloff. His new book is No Rain in the Amazon, How South America's Climate Change Affects the Entire Planet. Maybe after the movie Avatar, more people will care about the Amazon and its people. Maybe. Scientists have been worried about the world's great rainforest for a long time, called the lungs of the planet. Some hear the last gasp coming if the Amazon succumbs to human pressures and global climate change. We'll investigate all that and more with Nicholas Kozloff. He's written about the politics of the region in a 2008 book, Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left. Now Kozloff's latest is No Rain in the Amazon, How South America's Climate Change Affects the Entire Planet, just out from Palgrave Macmillan. Nicholas, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
It sounds somewhat impossible to most of us that the great rainforest could dry out. So let's dive in a bit gently with real-world events in Venezuela. There's a huge underreported story going on there. You've said that President Hugo Chavez may be facing his Katrina moment. Tell us what is going on.
In recent months, there's been a very severe drought in Venezuela, and this has affected the water levels in Venezuela's hydroelectric dams. The most important hydroelectric dam, the Guri Dam, supplies, I think, about 70% of the electrical power in the country. And Chavez himself has blamed the drought on the El Nino meteorological phenomenon, which is associated with the Pacific Ocean. El Nino has different kinds of effects in different parts of the Pacific Basin. In Peru, it results in flooding, whereas more inland, it can result in droughts. So I think, in part, Venezuela's energy crunch right now can be attributed to El Nino, although there are probably some other factors, for example, a lack of government investment in the electrical sector. One of the points that I was trying to make in the article is that it's rather ironic because you think of Venezuela as an energy powerhouse, and how could it be that Venezuela itself could be experiencing these problems?
Well, that's something I really admire about your article, something that makes me more likely to trust your writing, because despite much admiration for some good work Chavez has done, you point out that the emperor's clothes are all paid for by planet-killing oil exports. It's almost true that Chavez Venezuela is as much of a climate wrecker as the sheikhs of Saudi Arabia, would you say?
Right. I would say it's rather ironic because Chavez has been deriding affluent countries of the global north for their consumeristic lifestyle. And yet, Chavez owes much of his meteoric rise on the political world stage due to oil. I mean, the head of OPEC for a couple of years was Ali Rodriguez, a Venezuelan, actually a colorful character who was a communist rebel in Venezuela and who became Secretary General of OPEC, and he was a big price hawk in OPEC. So as a result, you know, Chavez benefited from the high price of oil, and he's used that oil largesse to extend his geopolitical influence both in South America and Central America. And also, ships discounted oil to poor communities in the U.S. So he certainly benefited from the high price of oil. So it's a little ironic that then he would turn around and say, and then deride affluent countries for being consumeristic when he's certainly, that's been the strength of his geopolitical power. The other point I was making in the article is that you could make the argument that Venezuela, not just Chavez, but over the course of the 20th century, through its exports of oil to the tune of millions and millions of barrels of oil, has contributed to global warming. If that's true, then perhaps that in turn exerted an impact on the El Nino effect, which scientists believe may be getting more intense and more frequent as a result of global warming.
But not all South American leaders feel that way. Some are beginning to question it. I noticed that in December last year, the UN announced a trust fund to pay Ecuador to leave oil in the ground in Yasuni National Park. And wasn't there a statement by another South American leader about leaving oil in the ground or gas to save the climate?
Well, I'm not sure of the last point, but certainly there have been some innovative proposals from the likes of Ecuador and President Rafael Correa. His proposal is called the ITT Yasuni proposal, and there's a pristine national park in the Ecuador and Amazon, because don't forget, the Amazon touches on many countries throughout the region, the largest being Brazil and Peru, but also Ecuador, Venezuela, Colombia, Bolivia. And so Correa's innovative proposal suggests that in exchange for not drilling for oil in this Yasuni National Park, that Ecuador be reimbursed to the tune of several billion, I don't know exact amount, but billions of dollars. And I think that that's an excellent proposal and worth looking at and considering. Nevertheless, I would say that a lot of the leaders of the so-called New Left in South America are a little caught up in this resource nationalism, and Correa is no exception, even though he had that interesting proposal. Chavez, Correa, and even Evo Morales in Bolivia, they're all caught up in this, enmeshed in this resource nationalism and extracting raw materials, and that in turn has set up a contradiction with the very people that propelled them into power, you know, the indigenous people that want ancestral rights over their lands and don't want the oil exploration. So as long as these leftist leaders fail to resolve this inner contradiction, I think it could set up a difficult political confrontation for them.
Well, I guess this is a good time to talk about the alternative climate meeting in South America. It's had about 1 inch of mainstream press here in North America, practically no TV time. Can you briefly tell us what that summit was about?
Many leaders in South America, Evo Morales included, have criticized the Copenhagen Climate Accord, I think it was back in December, for being inadequate and failing to address the needs of the countries of poor countries in the South, which are fighting to adapt to climate change and are really caught in the crosshairs of climate change, I think, to a greater degree, say, than nations of the North. And so Morales, who's actually been a kind of a Johnny-come-lately to the environment, nevertheless had this excellent idea of launching this alternative summit in the city of Cochabamba. And basically the idea is to press for deeper emissions cuts, for clean energy transfer, to address environmental refugees, and also, perhaps most provocatively, pushing for a climate justice tribunal, which at this point is rather symbolic. Oh, and also a referendum on, a global referendum on passing greater emissions. And so a lot of these measures are, I think, somewhat idealistic and some might say more symbolic and moral in nature than actually yielding practical results. But I think Evo Morales is trying to cast himself as the moral spokesperson on climate change. And I think, notwithstanding his resource nationalism, which hasn't always had protection of the environment in mind, I think Bolivia has some moral standing on the environment because, you know, indigenous people in Bolivia have had their glaciers, have witnessed glaciers melting, and so they're paying the price for the global north in action.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with author Nicholas Kozloff. Let's get to your new book, No Rain in the Amazon. First of all, can you orient us a bit? How big is the Amazon and why does it matter to the rest of the planet?
We're talking about a vast area. It's the same size as the 48 contiguous United States. So imagine just from Vermont to California down to Texas. It's just vast. It's 40% of the South American continent, bordering on many countries. Like I said before, Brazil and Peru, for example, have the largest swaths of Amazonian rainforest. And those are the two countries that I concentrated most on in the book. When I went down there, you know, interviewed scientists, environmentalists, and the like. But, you know, borders on many countries. So this is by far the biggest component of our deforestation problem. There are other rainforests. For example, you have Indonesia, Sumatra, Democratic Republic of Congo, but the Amazon is by far the most important component. My point in the book is to essentially say that while many people were concentrating on the Amazon in the 1990s, you had a number of celebrities like Sting and others going down to the Amazon to halt hydroelectric dams and the like. And all of that, I think, is very important. The point of my book, though, is to point out the climate component, because the Amazon rainforest has a lot of carbon stored in the vegetation and trees. And so when you have deforestation, that results in CO2 emissions. And I think people far too often pay attention to the transport sector and other causes of global warming while ignoring the tropical deforestation.
I vividly recall photos in 2005 of wide mud banks where rivers used to run and the general drought in the Amazon. What do we know about that?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. I actually went to the jungle town of Iquitos in Peru, down in the Amazon, which was right in the crosshairs of some of that drought. And so I spoke to many witnesses. That was an interesting drought because usually drought in the Amazon is associated with the El Nino phenomenon, which rises out of the Pacific Ocean and which has a drought-like effect on the Amazon. But the interesting thing about the 2005 drought is that, according to scientists, it didn't have anything to do with the Pacific Ocean, but warming currents in the Atlantic. So that was a real warning shot to, I think, many people in the region because, you know, El Nino is a naturally occurring phenomenon, and now it may be accelerating and becoming even more intense through global warming. But if you add on to that warming currents in the Atlantic having impact on the Amazon, then that is certainly a matter of grave concern. And the 2005 drought occurred in a really strange region. It was in the western Amazon, Peru, down in Bolivia, and that's usually not, doesn't suffer those kinds of severe weather events. So it kind of caught a lot of people off guard, and a lot of people were displaced. And, you know, much of the transport in the Amazon is by boat. And so if the river dries out, you're just stranded. And in addition, you know, you got a lot of wildlife. For example, the manatee, which is an aquatic mammal, dying out as a result of the drought, and, you know, just tons of fish being left on the banks of rivers. And so this is an ominous sign for the future.
Well, as you know, not everyone agrees with the Hadley Center prediction that, they said the temperatures could increase by as much as 18 degrees Fahrenheit and rainfall dropping by as much as 60% by 2100. That's from the Met Office in the UK. But there have been 9 other studies, I understand, ranging from agreement with that prediction all the way to the Lawrence Livermore study suggesting the Amazon will take up even more CO2 in 2100 due to stimulated plant growth. What makes you adopt the drying scenario?
Many prominent scientists who have studied the issue, for example, Philip Fernside, who's American, who's been working in the city of Manaus for 25, 30 years, and he's the most cited scientist on climate science in the Amazon, and another guy by the name of Lovejoy, who's the advises the president of the World Bank, who's a very recognized expert in the field, have warned about the possibility of drying out. And fact is, if you have consecutive El Niños, and El Niños becoming more frequent, the Amazon will dry out, and some prominent scientists warn that you could get a savanna-type environment, which wouldn't result in a desert in the Amazon. But if you have a change from a rainforest to a savanna, that's going to have severe repercussions. You could have impact on world precipitation. You have less precipitation, for example, in the central U.S. as a result of the Amazon collapsing. And that could have a lot of economic ripple effects on agriculture in the U.S. So I think there's enough reason to be concerned and enough scientists warning about this. And I think maybe we can't say the definitive word about it, but I think enough experts have warned about it, and it's worth really considering.
I've seen other studies which suggest there may be a tipping point in that Amazon basin based on the amount of rainforest that remains. At some point, there isn't enough left to keep the cycle of rain and cloud creation going. What are the main forces reducing the size of the rainforest?
Okay. In my book, I break that down pretty systematically. Deforestation is a social, economic, and political problem. And the causes of deforestation vary depending on the country. In Brazil, you've got a lot of powerful economic interests, including agribusiness, the biofuels industry, and landless settlers that are actually being pushed by a lot of these powerful economic interests. In Peru, you have less powerful economic interests, and there it tends to be more the timber trade and actually, interestingly enough, a coca leaf for cocaine production. But I guess my point is that the U.S., I'm trying to direct this book a lot to an American audience and people in the global north. And my point is that, you know, while a lot of these issues are social economic problems rooted in South American societies, the United States, you know, through its backing of the Inter-American Development Bank and by buying tropical commodities, you know, contributes to a lot of these problems. So in my view, in order to solve this problem, it's going to require a massive collaboration between South America, North America, Europe, and it's going to have to be a radical redesign and reorientation of the Amazon, which might sound ambitious, but I think the alternative would be just an incredible carbon spiral downward and potentially a drying out of the rainforest with severe repercussions.
So we've got soy being grown for animal feed. We've got things like, well, just plain hamburgers coming out of beef from the Amazon. So what can we do as consumers, perhaps, to help preserve this Amazon rainforest?
You mentioned soy and cattle, which are kind of go hand in hand together. Those are two chief drivers of deforestation in Brazil currently. And the reason they're linked is because, you know, cattle has become internationalized. When you talk about cattle ranchers in Brazil, maybe people have this idea of just some guy out in the middle of the Amazon and a low scale production. But these companies are hugely international now, billions of dollars. So they're exporting the beef and products made from beef all over the world. So it could be in the upholstery in your car through leather. It could be in your hamburger. And then soy, when people hear about soy, they may think that, oh, that's tofu. That's what I eat in the Japanese restaurant or edamame or something. And when you eat it in an appetizer in fancy upscale restaurants. But, you know, the fact is that now soy is being used as soy meal to feed animals. And this is a huge international problem now because the Chinese that want to ape middle class lifestyle think that it's a status symbol to consume meat, and all of that meat has to be fed with the soy meal. And so a lot of that soy meal is going to China and also to Europe. But as far as your question, we have to, well, one thing you could do is require green standards for the tropical commodities that get consumed in the global north. But I would go further. I mean, I think you might just consider abolishing the cattle and soybeans, and that would be very tricky politically and would require, I think, massive collaboration between the global north and global south, massive bailout to the tune of tens of billions of dollars per year to create agroforestry and other better alternatives in the Amazon that would preserve the rainforest and not result in carbon emissions. as opposed to the agribusiness. But that has been discussed, but so far the U.S. has not stepped up and really taken this issue on seriously.
What do you see as the most promising international initiative to try and preserve our climate by saving more of the Amazon?
Well, I see it as the reducing emissions through deforestation proposal. This has been gaining some traction in international meetings and events, and yet the funding and many other mechanisms have proven inadequate so far. And I think, well, basically, the idea is that that the global north would pay Brazil, say, to stop deforesting the rainforest in light of the fact that it can't get its emissions under control. Now, that's a little strange when you think about it, because the global south didn't create this problem historically. You know, most of global warming got accelerated as a result of industrialization since the late 18th century. And that was, Europe, Russia, the U.S. And so you would think that it's their responsibility to do it. So it's a little problematic from a moral standpoint to then say, well, the global south should solve this problem. Yet, if the reducing emissions through deforestation proposal can put real money into this problem and save the rainforest, then I think it could be beneficial. The only thing is that it would have to be massively rethought, because right now the World Bank is handling some of the money, and I think that's a total mistake, because the World Bank has historically funded boondoggle environmental initiatives in the Amazon, hydropower and cattle and such. So I don't think the World Bank should be in charge of those kinds of funds. The other thing is that any reducing emissions through deforestation proposal would have to solve social inequality and do environmental protection. And that's very ambitious. If you don't solve both at the same time, it's not going to work. So what do I mean by that? You've got to resettle all those landless squatters in Brazil, but you've got to do it outside of the Amazon, because right now what the government is doing is resettling those people inside of the Amazon on state land, and that doesn't solve the problem. But, the Brazilian government, which is run by President Lula, who, to his credit, has had some positive environmental proposals, but he's compromised by agribusiness, and he doesn't want to resettle people on, private land outside of the Amazon. That's a problem. So you're going to have to totally rethink land reform and handle all of these complex issues, and you're going to have to find other viable economic pursuits for people in the Amazon, such as sustainable crops, such as Brazil nuts, or a medicinal plant for pharmaceutical purposes, perhaps local handicrafts or sustainable ecotourism. And so all of this would have to be funded to the tune of tens of billions of dollars by the global north if this is to be at all serious.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Can you give us your website so people can follow up on your work?
Sure. It's nikolaskozloff.com. That's NIKOLASKOZLOFF.com.
Thank you. Our guest has been Nicholas Kozloff. Look for his brand new book, No Rain in the Amazon, How South America's Climate Change Affects the Entire Planet. Thank you for being with us, Nicholas.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
How can I still be surprised when mainstream media tells another big lie or squelches an important story? And yet a couple of whoppers last week left me with jaw dropped again. After the government-backed assassination attacks on Toyota, the rival to government-owned General Motors, we were treated to an all-out top-down media blitz on the sudden success of GM. Headlines and newscasters proudly announced the local boys just paid $6.7 billion back to the American government and another $1.3 billion or more to the Canadians, 5 years ahead of schedule. Wow, General Motors cars are selling like hotcakes. Billions of dollars in profits must be rolling in. We see President Obama and his team self-congratulating and more airtime from the GM CEO, Ed Whitaker, saying, "We're back and we're the best. Yippee!" Except, It was all the big lie you hardly heard about. Much as I hate to cite Fox News or Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, it seems confirmed all those billions came not from big sales or profits, but right from the back pocket of taxpayers, again. In a shell game for the ages, TARP man Neil Barofsky confirmed GM used Treasury funds squirreled away in a bailout fund to pay out the loans. It's like saying, hey, I paid $50,000 off on my mortgage, but putting it all on Visa. In fact, GM has lost more billions over the last quarters, totaling $4.3 billion in losses since their bankruptcy last July. Their next financial statement for the first few months of 2010 isn't due out until May, but sales are probably around 25% of what they were in 2007, which is great news for the atmosphere. If we really cared about our grandchildren, we wouldn't build another single oil-burning car. The world is already overpopulated with gas guzzlers. Still, shuffling billions in taxpayers' money and calling that success, that's an impressive con game, even by later American standards. Meanwhile, the Canadians play their own. Of course, you heard that climate scientist Andrew Weaver is suing a Canadian newspaper and several denialist journalists for libel. No? Well, maybe that's because the story has been censored in most Canadian media. I had to find out about it from a Radio EcoShock listener in Australia, where the story was republished from the Guardian newspaper in Great Britain. Andrew Weaver is a real climate scientist and a lead author of the 2007 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He was viciously attacked by a right-wing business newspaper called the National Post, especially by a hack called Terence Corcoran. In four newspaper articles and subsequent virulent comments, Weaver was accused of cherry-picking climate data in order just to keep his research money coming. These articles also claimed that there had been no increase in annual global mean temperatures and that climate models are, quote, falling apart. Weaver told The Guardian, if I sit back and do nothing to clear my name, these libels will stay on the internet forever, end quote. And he's taken the unusual step of demanding the National Post arrange a retraction from the various denier websites that used their attacks. The newspaper, he says, endorsed attack sites by linking to their reprints of the articles. Apparently, you can't just make up lies about climate scientists and climate science and get away with it anymore. I found news of this lawsuit in the overseas press, in the government-owned CBC, and in various blogs, but nothing about it in my local newspaper, even though Andrew Weaver is a well-known professor at the University of Victoria, not 100 miles from Vancouver. That is because Canada suffers from a horrible media monopoly known as CanWest. Established by the Asper family, CanWest owns both major newspapers here in Vancouver, plus a television station, and dozens more major newspapers across Canada, including the National Post. So when the newspaper chain is accused of libel, of printing things that are claimed to be grossly untrue, most Canadians don't get to hear anything about it. I call that censorship. Meanwhile, CanWest went bankrupt and the newspapers are up for sale. We can only hope the new owners will kick out the stable of climate deniers that have filled up so many pages with anti-science opinion and we love our tar sands hysteria. A vain hope, I know, but that's all we've got left. Meanwhile, we have to get ready for the big decline. Be sure and look for the article, The Imminent Crash of Oil Supply, Be Afraid, by Nicholas C. Argumbo. I found it at countercurrents.org. Thanks to a tip from listener, videographer, and longtime media activist Tom Childs. The graph of oil supplies comes from the United States Department of Energy, not from some hippies or far-out people. It is backed up by another report from the United States Military's Joint Forces of Command. We're running out of oil, folks. You will start to see it for real starting around 2012. Everybody knows it, and no one, not governments, not corporations, and not most of us, are really getting ready for a long, steep decline in world oil supply. Prices go way up. Food goes down. Economies crash for real. Look it up. As Argumbo points out, it can't be mere coincidence that the emission cuts from fossil fuels proposed by the American government happen to match their latest projections on the fuel that is left. Quote, 18% drop from 2005 by 2020, and an 85% drop from 2005 by 2050. Yep, that's what's going to happen, like it or not. The quick answer for local survival is rapid transition away from fossil dependence, from transition towns to localization, as we've been saying on Radio EcoShock for years. We've dropped from the possibility of a steady state economy, it's too late for that, to the new movement for degrowth. I'll be covering a degrowth conference for you soon, and next week we'll hear from one of the most credible witnesses for the need to quickly reduce our economies, a new speech from Dr. Bill Reese, the co-inventor of the ecological footprint. Reese questions whether our brain has evolved enough to cope with the challenges posed by peak oil and radical climate change. We'll begin our preparation for his speech with our next interview. A Harvard evolutionary psychologist helps me work through the big question, are we smart enough to survive? You have probably heard that animal studies have led to advanced theories about human psychology. The results may be used against you to sell products or even political candidates. Or maybe it will help us understand what parts of our brains we need to solve complex problems like energy addiction or climate change. We're going to hash this out a bit with Dr. Deirdre Barrett. She's a popular writer and also a psychology researcher at Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Deirdre.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, good to have you. And before we start, I'd like to clue listeners a little into your dual interests. Dream study and evolutionary biology seem worlds apart, but you do both. I know you publish specialized scientific research, but can you give us a brief look at your previous popular books?
Well, my first book was on hypnotherapy. It's called The Pregnant Man and Other Cases from a Hypnotherapist's Couch, about clinical work I'd done up until that time. And then The Committee of Sleep is about dreams and creative problem solving. And I have another book called Trauma and Dreams, whose title is obvious. And really the only connection between my interests in imagery via hypnosis and dreams and all and what my most recent two books are about is that theoretically I'm an evolutionary psychologist. I really think it's extremely important to always keep in mind that behavior has to have been adaptive to survival and in primeval settings rather than modern ones. So looking at what we as humans do today in terms of what that would have meant 10,000 years ago on the savannah is a very important way to think about human psychology.
Right. Well, I called you after reading a newspaper article with the unlikely headline, Latest Info, Don't Trust Your Gut. It was a review of your new book, A Supernormal Stimuli, and I thought right away, well, finally, a bit of light on why we humans continue to make such stupid choices long after we know the facts. Is that part of your book?
Definitely. I mean, I think that cliche that people like to say about, you know, just trust your gut or trust your instincts, listen to your instincts, that those are all really misguided. I mean, sometimes people think that evolutionary theory would suggest that our instincts should be adaptive to our survival, but that would only be true if we were still back in the setting where they evolved. Our instincts have not had any time to catch up to our modern high population density technological setting. So we have these instincts that were designed for hunting and gathering on the savannas of Africa, where all our prehuman ancestors were and the lifestyle that humans were living until just what's the blink of an eye in evolutionary history. So like in terms of food, we're programmed to look for sugar, look for salt, look for fat. We aren't programmed to look strongly for green leafy vegetables because they were all around us and we were busy seeking out the rarer nutrients that we need. And we just, our bodies haven't had time to adjust to the fact that we can suck all the fat and sugar and salt we want out of foods and concentrate them in these chunks of stuff that are really not good for us, but that appeal to our instincts more than what the instincts evolved for.
Could we then start, as your book does, with that intriguing portrait of the Dutch biologist Nico Tinbergen and his sometime sidekick Conrad Lorenz? Can you give us a nutshell view of how Tinbergen's research could help us with modern problems?
Well, the concept that I found most fascinating, and one which has not made it into the popular language as much as like Lorenz's idea of imprinting, the image of the little baby geese following him if he, rather than their mother, is in front of them for their formative first few hours. Lots of the concepts have made it into evolutionary psychology and even in just the popular language, but Tinbergen had this concept that he called a supernormal stimulus, which was after he did some animal research trying to illuminate what instincts were coded for in various, mainly non-mammal animals, fish and birds and insects. And he did all these experiments, like with birds, he was looking for what was coded for a healthy egg that they needed to sit on, because when they lay more than they can cover with their body, they will select what are the likeliest to hatch. And he found that they were not coded for the gestalt of a healthy ideal egg of their species, that there were just a few key stimulus that made them want to sit on this egg. And for most birds, whatever color the egg was, they liked a more saturated version. If they laid a pale blue egg, they liked a bright day glow blue egg. If they laid a pale brown egg, they liked a deep rich brown egg. If it had any sort of spots or dappling, even light gray dappling, then they liked big black polka dots. They liked bigger eggs than their real ones. So you could get this little bitty songbird that would lay pale gray-dappled eggs to sit on this just gigantic plaster, day-glow blue, dummy egg covered in these idiotic-looking polka dots. So it would, so big it would just slide off and have to hop back on continuously. And he found that almost every instinct was just coded for a few things like this. Once the chick hatched, parent birds preferred feeding a fake baby bird beak on a stick. It didn't even need a body if the dummy beak was wider or redder than the real chick's. And stickleback fish would ignore a real male in their territory, and they're very territorial, if you floated a dummy fish in whose underside was brighter red, even if it was a very unrealistic-looking fish. He could get butterflies to mate with fake cardboard butterflies in preference to a real female if the stripes down the side of the torso were more dramatic than on a real female. So for almost every instinct, there seemed to be just a few key signs that meant ideal mate or healthy offspring, you need to nurture this thing, or, you know, enemy, you need to fight and keep this out of your territory. And he and Lorenz were studying animals all this time, but when I read this research, it just seems so relevant to people that's what my book, Supernormal Stimuli, is doing, is applying Tinbergen's concepts to most of our modern human dilemmas.
But that's all a bit alarming and depressing in a way. I mean, does love really exist in nature? Are we all pre-programmed, just victims of stimuli, no matter how false they are?
I don't think it means that love doesn't exist, that we have, for romantic love, you know, some pretty strong, pretty simple cues for it, or for other sorts of you know, love of children, some pretty simple stimuli that indicate, you know, I'm cute, I need your help, and that our stuffed animals pull those instincts a little bit as well as our kids. It doesn't mean it's not real, but some of it is awfully simple and can be manipulated awfully easily and powerfully.
Well, Deirdre, there's been a long-standing argument against taking some biological observations into the complexities of human thought and or social organization. And so allow me this train of three quick questions coming to mind. First, I ask myself, have experiments been done with superstimuli in humans? And then I think, well, should they be done at all? And finally, I realize with all the advertising and propaganda and product design, uh-oh, we're living that experiment right now. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I mean, no one has done research on humans under the term supernormal stimulus, the way Tinbergen very carefully constructed different dummy fish to test and different sized plaster eggs to test and different fake cardboard butterflies to test. But yeah, I think that the issue is that animals usually only encounter a supernormal stimulus when an experimenter builds one, that in nature they're very unlikely to encounter an object that pulls their instinct more strongly than the real thing. That's why they haven't died off from these instincts. And in nature, they work very well. But with the dawning of our technological ability, we've basically just completely reversed the relationship between instinct and object. And instead of letting our instincts lead us toward natural objects, we've begun to manufacture objects that very specifically cater to instincts. It just feels right to us to make something that tastes as good as possible, or make something that looks as cute as possible, or make pornography, or make romance literature, or make television shows with laugh tracks and smiley faces on them. That, you know, if we can manufacture something that pulls one of our instincts, it feels good, and we don't even question it or think about it the way we do when we're doing the animal experiments, because the animal instincts immediately look sort of peculiar to us if they're directed to the wrong object. But our food instincts heading toward junk food, or sexual instincts, you know, headed toward a printed centerfold page, human instincts just feel normal to us and we don't question them.
Oh, boy. Well, if you've just tuned in, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest is Dr. Deirdre Barrett from the Harvard Medical School. We're talking about her new book, Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose, just published by W.W. Norton. So, Deirdre, I guess I'm getting the message here that these supernormal stimuli are being used against us as consumers.
Certainly. I think... advertisers are among the most sophisticated about producing supernormal stimuli, as though are any commercial industry. I mean, our food industry is manufacturing commercial products that are supernormal stimuli for our appetites. Toy companies are manufacturing supernormally cute stimuli. I think that it's not just advertisers, that we rather automatically, once we got the technological ability, started producing these things to cater to our instincts. And we're as pulled toward them as the animals are, although back to your question of whether you can really extrapolate from animals to humans with all of our reasoning process, I do think that's the key to a big difference, that when we recognize that we are essentially sitting on the bright blue polka-dotted egg, we do have the ability to think about that and climb off if we notice it. I mean, that's exactly what our giant brains are for, is to override simple instincts when they're leading us astray, to be able to abstractly process things and come up with more novel behaviors by reasoning. But the first step is recognizing the pull of the instinct and that we are responding to something supernormal that's not good for us. And that's where we're not usually doing that piece of it these days.
We're just not brain trained to think that way. Well, let's get down to business here, the business of applying what we know to difficult times. You wrote in an email that our instincts about dangers and self-protection are coded for hostile humans or to pick up dangerous animals or maybe some big disaster, but not really for big issues like planetary warming or depletion of our resources. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, yes, all of our instincts to get alarmed, to sense a danger, to feel like we need to take action to defend ourselves, they're all basically coded for threats that would have been there on the African savanna in hunting and gathering days. So whether it's things that we respond to dramatically in the real world, like when leaders start talking about some super enemy halfway around the world who's developed this terrible weapon and we need to wipe them out before they wipe us out, and motivate a war with that kind of language, we're coded for things like dangerous humans, dangerous animals. And you see it in a more comical way in the sort of disaster films and adventure and horror films that get our attention. I mean, the film titles read almost like an inventory of our primal back on the savannah sort of fears. I mean, there are movies like Arachnophobia, Ticks, Empire of the Ants, Rabbit Infested, Killer Rats, Plague, Outbreak Virus, Twister, Backdraft Tornado, you know, and or if the titles don't have it, the images have these like huge jaws of a shark or huge jaws of a rabbit animal or earthquake swallowing up the earth. I mean, anything that was a danger back then is really, really coded into our genes. I mean, any human back in those times who fought tornado, man-eating tiger, people dying of mysterious disease, I don't really care. I mean, those people didn't leave many offspring, so we're coded for those things. But we're not coded for something like the planet is gaining a fraction of a degree in temperature every year. You know, there are no horror films about a large number of the elderly population dying slowly of flu over the course of the winter. These were just not dramatic events that got our attention. So we overrate anything that plays to those primal, bad person, dangerous animal, natural disaster, and we underrate any other sort of dangerous event, no matter how many people it's killing or, you know, or what the long-term prognosis may be. So I think the take-home message for environmentalists is that, first of all, one way around the pull of supernormal stimuli and the lack of pull of some modern problems is just to be very aware of this concept of supernormal stimulus and of inaccuracies in our threat estimates, and to educate people about those kind of natural, you know, don't trust your instincts about what's dangerous. We really need to think that through. But then also, to the extent that if you're going to do advertising campaigns to get people aware of things like global warming, you want to put it in some concrete terms that do try to tie into those things, some image of your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren who are going to be running out of fuel and freezing or flooded out of their homes by rising ocean heights, or to translate, even if it has to be sort of into the distant future, to something that, you know, is going to happen to you and your loved ones in a very concrete way, that grabs people's attention more powerfully.
And in this world where we're super stimulated by all sorts of online games and many, many sources of information, I guess we need a very strong stimulus to get any kind of attention at all to these issues.
Yes, definitely. And to really use the ones that do. You mentioned online games. It would be nice to have some online games about fighting global warming rather than all about fighting terrorists.
Yeah, and you've said that the scientists may have drifted into dangerous games like the ultimate nuclear bomb instead of more mundane plays like solar or wind power because they find that work stimulating. Is that what you did say?
I think that in addition to having instincts about nurturing and sex and eating and some of those things we obviously think about as drives, that one drive humans have is curiosity and a pull toward intellectual complexity. And I mean, you see, we spend huge amounts of time playing games. I mean, from old-fashioned crossword puzzles and chess to modern, you know, online computer games. Things that are intricate play really intrigue human beings. And I think that a lot of our careers and a lot of our science is determined by what's interesting. So what I was writing about in Supernormal Stimuli is that I think that the direction science will most easily go is toward what the complex, intellectually challenging, interesting problems are, and that's part of why splitting the atom got worked out early on, and part of why harnessing solar power and harnessing wind energy hasn't gotten as much time and attention. Part of it is that supernormal stimulus toward threat and make the bomb was certainly the number one motivation for nuclear energy. But the fact that atomic physics is so inherently interesting to smart people, I think, was another big piece of it. Whereas solar and wind energy are the kind of fancy plumbing. They're kind of simple concepts, and I don't think they grab scientists quite the same way. And again, I think that we have the ability to override those sorts of instinctive pulls and priorities once we really stop and think about them. But recognizing when a supernormal stimulus is running the show is the first step in beginning to question that and redirect some of our resources if we want to.
Right, so I'm kind of coming out of this with three possible defenses. The first, as you say, is to recognize when we're being played. And the second might be if we could use supernormal stimuli for good instead of self-destructive crud. And then the third, and this is perhaps too much even to dream about, is that we emphasize our rational selves and use what rationality we can to save ourselves.
Yes. And I think that we want to get the supernormal stimuli much lessened in our environment. I mean, we're never going to completely abandon technology and not have any of them. But I think that there are, if you're talking about energy and global warming, there are equivalents to things like what we obviously want to do with foods, which is stop having as much junk, artificial concentrations of refined carbohydrates and fats and salt, and go back to eating a much more natural diet, and tax trans fats and not advertise junk food to children, and rearrange our subsidies so that we promote the growing of fresh vegetables, and just shift the kinds of foods that are around us. It becomes a lot easier to eat healthy than if you as an individual have to always reason about, I should be eating the leafy vegetables, I should be ignoring these milkshakes and french fries here. It's just easier when we rearrange the environment. And so similarly, I think in terms of energy consumption and what our energy sources are, that one of the instincts that our automobiles and lots of our devices are playing to is that we're coded for this instinct that sort of says rest when you don't need to be exercising. I mean, on the savanna, there were enough things we had to exercise for. You were going to run away from the predatory animal. You were going to chase the prey that you were after. You had to move around to hunt and gather. You had to build your shelter. But when you weren't doing one of those things, it wasn't a good idea to be using lots of extra energy, and you wanted to rest when you didn't need to do one of those things. But now we have very few physical tasks that we have to do. Work is not very physical. And so our instincts are still saying rest when you don't absolutely need to exercise, and yet most of us are getting not nearly enough exercise for health. So if we can get some of those, quote, labor-saving devices out of our environment, when right now we do not need to be saving physical labor. We need to be exerting ourselves a bit more physically. So not having as many cars, not using them as much, walking more, bicycling more, getting ourselves to use more of our simple muscle power and like I say, less of these labor-saving devices is not a good idea in many cases.
Well, we may have to rearrange our industrial landscape to suit our rather primitive brains. That's one thing I'm getting out of this. And here's the final question as we wrap up, I think. Do you think that humans have the evolutionary equipment to survive the problems of this civilization?
Yes. I think that our very elaborate cortex and our unique ability to reason around instincts, that we have powerful, primitive, simple instincts like any animal, but we also have this program to be able to notice when they're to our detriment and stop and reason out a completely novel line of activity that we aren't programmed for specifically and that we've never practiced before. That other sort of reasoning ability is what can potentially save us from our ecological disastrous problems, from our wars, our weapons, that the way out of any of our really big crises is through our brains and their ability to override simple instincts. But again, sort of noticing and understanding what the problem is the first crucial step there.
Well, I think you've taken a good step with this book, and my thanks to Dr. Deirdre Barrett, author of Supernormal Stimuli, How Primal Urges Overran Their Evolutionary Purpose. It is a rewarding book and a surprisingly easy read given the difficulty of the subject, so that's a sign of a good author. Thank you so much for being with us, Deirdre.
Interesting talking to you.
You too. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Broadcast on 20 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive. This is Vanessa Richards with Occupying Army.
Fruit of my trees, fish of my seas, wheat of my field, everything you need. You act like I never gave you enough. I gave you my very own body to suck. You act like I never gave you enough. I gave you my very own body to suck. For ruin is glory denied, and violence is not virtuous. The things you do are hurting us. Violence is not virtuous. The things you do are hurting us. Treat me.
You're not an occupying army, you are of me. Treat me